see you all with us. We have people standing in the back. If there is an empty seat next to you, could you please raise your hand nice and high so the people in the back can see where the empty seats are? Thank you. So, this is Discrete Mathematics, CS2102. I hope I'm in the right room. Did all of you expect a different class? Great. All right. My name is Professor Tychonovich, Luther Tychonovich, whatever you want to call me. I will say a little bit more about that. Yeah, let's say a little bit more about that. Because people have trouble with my name, you pronounce it like this. Tychonovich.
I like to hear people chant my name. It makes me feel special. So when I count to three, you're all going to say my name back to me. One, two, three. Tychonovich. Ah.
Beautiful. All right, great. Got it, first try. So, Luther Tychonovich, either one works. If I know you're addressing me, I will try to respond. Any honor to pick you up, or none at all. It's all fine how that goes. This is one of three sections of discrete mathematics. The other two sections are being taught by Kevin Sullivan. They are not synchronized in material. So if you are in my section, you are not learning in the same order or same way necessarily as the other section. The end learning objectives are the same, so you need to go to the section you're in. Also, a lot of you aren't actually in the class. Technically, having people sitting in chairs in the hallways and on the steps and so on could potentially get the fire marshal angry at us. Anyway, so we have a wait list. And there's only so much I can do about this. The space is only the space it is. Last semester when I taught this class, I think we had 8 people drop. So I do not expect a large waitlist churn, and I am sorry. I will talk to people and see if there's any magical way I can increase limits, but at present I'm not expecting many people to get off the waitlist. So you know. So let's talk a little bit about what this class covers, and then we'll talk about how this class runs, and then we'll open up to questions, and we'll move on from there. So, the topic of this class, discrete mathematics. Turn to where you're sitting next to you and describe what you believe discrete means in this title. We have bad opinions about our fellow students. I'm sorry to hear that. Well, maybe that'll change as the semester progresses. I'm just going to describe to you the topics that we're covering. I'm not actually going to define discrete right now. We'll come back to that later. The main goal of this class is to get you ready for other classes. In particular, get you ready for other computing classes. Discrete mathematics is also taught in the math department as a senior level elective. And we're going to teach it without all of its prereqs, which means we're going to teach half-ish of what they teach, and a handful of other ideas so that you don't have to take 4 or 5 semesters of math to get to the math we need. Okay? So this is a math class. We are teaching you math. You will not be asked to write any programs in this class. You will not be asked to do computing as you usually think of it. We're going to teach you in particular the math you need for later classes you to be able to do the following basic tasks. We're going to want to be able to say things like, some algorithm is correct. Or we might want to say some algorithm is faster than another. Or we might want to be able to say some task cannot be done. These are the kinds of claims you want to be able to make about programs and algorithms and the discipline of computer science. Once you're able to make these claims, we want to teach you how to make and understand these claims. And it's easy to say this algorithm is correct, but what do we mean by it? So this class is going to try to teach you the math necessary for you to end up
at the end with a proof of these claims. Okay?
Proofs are a goal of this class. We're going to teach you how to write proofs. You may have had some of this if you took geometry.
It will look different here. Anyway, we will go through that. We will teach you about proofs. The basic steps you're going to do is you're going to turn this statement into math, and then you're going to turn that math into a proof.
Okay?
Both of these processes, the turning statement into math and turning math into proof, will require some challenges.
And we're going to try to walk through some of those things.
The name for turning the statement into math has different terms that are sometimes used, but we're going to use the word formalize.
Algorithm X is correct is an informal statement. We want a formal statement of the same thing. What do we mean by correct? What do we mean by algorithm X? What do we mean by is?
Right? We want to turn this into math. And so we're going to be this process of formalizing English.
Formalizing English statements into math.
You've probably done some of this, probably to your own regret, when you had word problems in your math classes. It's the same concept. It's going to look somewhat different with these kinds of claims.
The set of math we're going to use is also not going to be necessarily a set of math you're used to from algebra class and so forth,
although algebra will still be useful. We're going to primarily work with a handful of different techniques as we're dealing our math. The math we're going to translate things into is going to end up having a lot of integers. We're almost never going to use real numbers.
They'll show up a few times, in particular as we deal with logarithms, we'll get to that in a moment.
But most of what we're going to do is integers instead. And this is actually part of the idea of discrete mathematics,
as opposed to continuous mathematics. Real numbers are continuous. You pick two, there's another one in between, no matter which two you picked. Integers are not. They come in discrete individual chunks. There is no integer between one and two.
We're going to deal with a lot of discrete things like integers. Sets and logic as mathematical constructs will be a big part of what we're going to deal with. There's going to be a variety of other things. We're going to have sequences and functions and relations and graphs, and we'll get to some of these as well. These will be arguably less important than the first three.
We're going to teach you new things about all of these, including new things about integers. Who knew, right?
As we go through this class. These are all discrete mathematical topics. They all have discrete definitions that we're going to deal with as we go along. We're also going to talk about how to count. We're going to talk more about how to count than you probably thought there was.
Arguably, what we're really doing here is taking a tiny little part of probability. Some of you will see more of this when you take a probability class.
Some of you won't take a probability class. We're going to talk about the specific parts necessary to do things like something is faster than something else. There will be some counting techniques we're going to deal with. And then we're going to talk about logarithms, which really is just sort of tack on extra.
When the standard set of computing classes was defined back many years ago across the discipline, logarithms are something we could assume everybody had in high school. We can't anymore, so now we teach it here. And it's not really related to the other things we're going to do, but
it's math, and it's necessary for later classes, so huzzah, we get to teach it. Okay? So we're going to talk about those things. We're also going to talk about various techniques for creating proofs. In particular, we're going to talk about four proof techniques. We're going to talk about direct. We're going to talk about cases. We're going to talk about induction. And we're going to talk about contradiction. These are not the only proof techniques that exist, but they're going to give us a lot of the techniques that you'll need to answer questions like, is this algorithm correct? As we move forward. So we'll introduce these techniques, how they work, how they structure proofs. And then we're going to have you actually write proofs. And we'll spend a little bit of time later today talking about what proofs are and different kinds of proofs.
But this is the course. We'll spend the semester on the things on the board, teaching you, exploring the different ideas here as we move forward.
So this is the scope of the class. Let's talk also about the running of the class.
First off, all that we Piazza has is a link to a webpage. I find Piazza to be awkward. Sorry, not Piazza. Collab.
Oh, Collab has a link to a webpage. I find Collab to be awkward to use. Everything will be on the webpage instead. So just so you know that, you can find that. Let's go to the policies page.
Hopefully this is all correct. We will meet Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Yes, that is true. In this room. Hooray. I got it right. All right.
Monday and Wednesday lecture is optional.
I strongly encourage correlated with success in the course, but you don't have to show up. As a matter of fact, in order to help you not have to show up, I record all of my lectures, screen capture and audio, which I will sync and upload to the website several hours after class, typically.
In fact, this little red dot in the bottom of the screen means the screen is being captured and recorded. If you come to class and I start talking and you don't see that, remind me so that I can start my recording. Typically, some part of the recording tech fails about once a semester. I can't predict when that will happen, but it likely will happen. I hope it won't. I don't try to have my tech fail, but just so you know, there's a reasonable chance that one session won't be recorded. Now, Friday is different. Friday will be exercised like a little mini lab. The first half of class, you'll have some exercises to work on. We'll have TAs here. We'll sort of help you understand how to work that in application, what we talked about on Monday and Wednesday. And then the second half of class will be an in-class quiz. And so Friday's attendance is not optional, assuming you want credit on your quizzes. So what are you expected to do? Read. I actually do hope you will read. I will go over things in class, but I do not generally organize class on the assumption that you know nothing going in. I generally organize class on the assumption that you did the reading and I will clarify the confusing bits. And so just be aware of that. And then you'll have in-class quizzes and lab activities preceding. There will also be a weekly online quiz that will all be part of what we expect you to do. And then at the end of the semester, there will be a final quiz, which I hope to make optional based on how you did on the previous material. So those are the things you're supposed to do. Here is me and our TAs. I'm meeting with my TAs tomorrow. Hopefully we'll have some office hours up for them soon. We'll be using Piazza as opposed to email for course-related content. People that do not understand Piazza need me to say more. Great. All right, then I will skip saying more about that. Also, just a reminder, TAs are students. When they're being a TA, please use them. When they're not being a TA, please let them be students. We'll have two free online textbooks, the Mathematics for Computer Science, or MCS, as well as the 4LX Calgary Remix, which is a strange name. Anyway, both of them are linked here. You can also get them both in the source. And section numbers for those are listed on the course website, on the schedule. We'll get to that in a moment. You'll write proofs, grades.
What to say about grades? The plan is not to use just a point-based grading system in this class. Every activity you do, every rubric on the in-class quiz grading rubrics, and every question on the online quizzes will be assigned to a different topic, and we'll bucket the topics and use points in the topics to understand how well you're doing in them. So in each topic, you're going to be listed as being currently insufficient, competent, or mastery of that topic. And there will be a combination of the topics that will correspond to your letter grades. I had hoped to know exactly what the set of topics would be. I have a meeting tomorrow with our TAs where we'll finalize that, so we'll talk some more about this probably Wednesday when you know exactly what that looks like. But the idea is, if you are great at three topics and horrible at one, you're still not ready necessarily for the next class, depending on what the one you're horrible is. You're going to try to do something a little bit more useful like that. So we'll come back and talk about this again. This is also based on our department's definition of letter grades, which I have summarized here and linked to if you're interested in more. My goal, though, is that you will not be surprised. The progress tracker page will show you how you were doing at any given point in time. A lot of opportunities to redo things that didn't go well. So you shouldn't be surprised or unable to fix a mistake as things come up. We won't redo evaluations. The moment an online quiz closes, the key is released. So if you're late, you don't get to take it. The in-class exercises will be done just in class. If you miss it, even for a legitimate reason, the response is going to be,
we'll have an opportunity for you to make up what you missed at the end with the final quiz and the last quiz of class. So both the opportunities to fix things that you missed. There's just too many people for me to schedule multiple fixing sessions per week, which is what I would need to do otherwise. So that will happen there. That because you can make up everything in the final quiz, you theoretically could do no assignments until the final and then do great on the final. But UVA policy says you have to take a class to get credit. So I will expect to see some evidence of continuing engagement and learning throughout the course, as well as performance along the things. And you should be good people and kind to others and say truth. Tell me if you get help. And if you have disability or other things that get in the way of ordinary class working, the sooner I know about them, the sooner we can make your life better. And so that is the course policies. The other thing I'll just mention right now is the course schedule. We'll have links to the readings and so on. So you can see, for today, example, today, we encourage you to read the introduction of our two texts, as well as a write-up on groups that we'll get to in a moment. And there will be similar things linked from each of the days, what you should read. There will be links to the online quizzes as materials prepared for the in-class quizzes there as well. That is my summary of the course. Now what I would like you to do, because I've gone relatively quickly, is I would like you to turn to your right next to and come up with a question. It could be about anything, technically. I'm hoping a lot of them will be out of the course, but if everything is perfectly clear about the course, come up with a different question. I will then randomly call on a few of you to ask your questions before opening up more generally. So come up with a question, and we'll proceed from there. First question. Row 8, section 2. 8, that's this row. And section 2, 6 is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. What's your question? Yeah. No, sorry, one closer. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let me go ahead and compute another one of these, and then I'll write it down. What's going on? Here we are. All right. Oh, all right. On the end of the second row, you. What's your question? All right. All right, let me go into my questions. And so we're just going to write these down. Favorite color and midterm exam. All right, other questions you have? Yes?
So does hockey use Dutch line? For the final quiz, if you show mastery in one subject and not the other, do you have to take both of them or just one?
Okay.
Is there an in-class and out-of-class quiz every week? And is there a homework every week?
Huh?
Do you always have this energy?
Okay? Yeah?
What does the discrete and discrete mathematics mean?
Yeah?
Is the final exam in the final quiz the same thing?
Okay. Let's rearrange things a little bit. Wrong one. All right. Let's put this up here. Let's put this down here. Yeah, all right. Let's start with the story of how the course works. Will there be midterm exams? No. Okay, quizzes will be what you have. Everything is a quiz. Dutch knockout. I'm not familiar with why we would associate Holland with any particular grading system. I don't know. I don't know what that means. Yes.
Yeah, the Dutch knockout is basically like, I only heard about this an hour ago, so it's like,
that is not how it would work. Okay? And so this next question gets at that a little bit. The final quiz. Final quiz will be administered in discrete topics. There will be a page or two per topic. You can take any subset of the pages you want. And if you take a page, it will replace your grade in that topic. Complete or replace, high or lower, either way, if you decide to take that page. Yes? Then you don't show up for the final. And I don't have to grade your final. It wins everybody. So, if you take the final, what you did before that just doesn't matter, except that you showed up and were alive in class. Is the final exam the same thing as the final quiz? Yes. All right, let's go here. Will there be an in-class and out-of-class quiz every week? Mostly? We will probably, the schedule currently lists when these will be. We will probably pick one or two of the in-class quizzes and replace them with additional material instead, because we've got a few more of them than we really need. I'm not sure exactly which ones those will be. But as a baseline, you will have an online quiz due 8:30 in the morning every Monday. That will be released probably an hour or two after class on Friday. And then every Friday in class, you will have a quiz with possibly a few exceptions. And so we'll get to see some more of those as they come up. You don't have one next Monday, though, because no school. All right, homework every week. There is no homework, just quizzes. That said, that does not mean you shouldn't be working at home, right? I'm just not going to spend energy grading what you do at home. And there's a reason for it. There's several reasons for that. I do grade what you do at home in the online quizzes. You will do them at home. We won't do them in class. And so there is homework that is graded. find it is always tempting to use resources you shouldn't when nobody is watching you. So we're going to watch you do a lot of things. Then you won't be tempted, right? Anyway, this is part of the reason we'll do a lot of in-class quizzes. It'll also give us an opportunity to clarify things if they are wrong and so forth. Yeah. Any following questions to this first group of questions? Yes?
So are the out-class quizzes timed?
Are the online quizzes, the current plan is to have them not be timed, besides the deadline. The system we use allows timed quizzes that didn't appear to have much benefit, so I don't expect we will use it. But I might change my mind in theory. If I do, I'll announce that. Yes?
Will there be any dropped quizzes?
Will there be dropped quizzes? The plan is for everything you take to demonstrate what you know. And so if you don't demonstrate that you know something, you'll have another opportunity to demonstrate that later. So in practice, that means no, there won't be dropped quizzes. As an exception to that, I am not perfect at writing unambiguous online quizzes. And so it is not uncommon, not super common, but there's a likelihood that one, maybe two quizzes, or many individual questions, probably half a dozen over the semester, we will get in class and we will discover there is a major ambiguity, and occasionally a question will get dropped from everybody because it was broken. I hope to minimize that, but reality, that happens. But the plan is not to say, oh, you did poorly on this quiz, we drop it. You did poorly on that quiz, it suggests you either didn't know the material or had a bad day. Either way, you can come and show us better with the final. The last quiz of the semester, the last in-class quiz, will likely also be an opportunity to make up one or two things so that if you're just one topic before the final, you can do it before the final instead. We'll see if that will actually work with the way the semester is organized this semester. Other questions about these sorts of things? Yes?
Will a calculator be required for this course?
Will a calculator be required? No, as a matter of fact, a calculator will not even be permitted. This is in marked difference from the other section. So the other sections of discrete math will not only, won't actually just use standard calculators, they'll use a special proof-writing calculator called LEAN, Theorem Assistant. And there is always disagreements between people teaching math about whether calculators are good or bad. And so we'll find out as we see how people do in the two versions of the course. That is an exaggeration. There are so many other things different about the courses. Anyway, but if you love calculators, there are two other sections that will use proofwriting calculators. Other questions? All right. How connected are math and code, or how, I think actually the question was, will I show how they're connected? I will try. Sometimes you'll just have to talk about the math. But I'll try to always anchor it to what's going on, and if you don't see how it's related, ask. I welcome interruptions, questions, and so forth in class, and will do my best to react to them as they appear. And even occasionally off-topic ones like favorite color, although if those become too common, we may do something about that. Anyway, so yeah, please, if you don't understand why we're doing something, I will try to explain it if you'll let me know that you didn't understand. Discrete means not continuous. Okay, so discrete in English has two primary definitions. One means good at keeping secrets-ish, right? A discrete individual doesn't share very much. That isn't what we mean by discrete mathematics. The other one is separable into distinct buckets. That is what we mean here. And so, in particular, integers and sets and many of the math we will be doing are discrete math as opposed to continuous math. Favorite color. There's a lot of things I don't understand about most humans. And one of them is how they can have emotional reactions to colors. I understand most people have favorite colors. It has always struck me as odd. I don't understand how you could prefer a color to another color. Sorry. Am I always this energetic unless I'm asleep? I am a basically high energy person at all times. And sorry if that annoys you, there's another instructor who actually I might be energetic too. I've never said in this class. All right. Any other questions? Yes?
Do you have a favorite number?
What? Favorite number?
Yeah.
For what purpose? Great. No, I don't understand why, I mean, for certain things, there are better numbers, right? Like, the best number of people to play board games with is 5, for example. But that you have the purpose in order to know what number is good. Yes?
What is the likelihood that you'll be teaching a section of this class in the fall?
What is the likelihood I'll teach this class in the fall? Yeah.
Favorite emotion?
The quality of emotions is directly proportional to their appropriateness for the situation. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite category from which to pick a favorite?
No. I don't have very many favorites. I'm not good at universal superlatives. Qualitative superlatives, I can do okay. But universals? Yeah.
Do you have a favorite anything?
Do I have a favorite anything? If you have enough qualifiers, I have favorite things. Like, for example, my favorite number of people who play board games with is 5. Right? Although that depends a little on the board game. So, anyway, yeah. All right. Any other questions before we dive into more about proofs? Okay, let's talk about proofs. This is my second semester teaching this class. I did a fair amount of this material earlier in my graduate work and so forth, but hadn't taught it since I had been hired here. And as I was preparing for the class, I realized that there was something that I knew and a lot of other people I knew that did mathy, proofy things that I couldn't find written down anywhere. So I tried to write it down. I'm not sure I did the best I could be done, but I couldn't find it written anywhere else, so it's what we've got. And the main thing I want to try to get across is this word proof. We're going to spend a long time in this class talking about proofs, but the word proof isn't a single thing. So we're going to talk about various varieties of proof. The first one we talk about is a colloquial proof. Okay? A colloquial, in case you're not familiar with the word colloquial, it means other pertaining to casual conversation. A colloquial proof is a loose, hand-wavy, I'm just trying to convince you of something is probably true. Okay? And there are several specific examples. There's a whole category of things called logical fallacies that are almost always colloquial proofs. For example, I have a PhD, and you don't, so we disagree, I'm right, and you're wrong. This has the vague structure of a colloquial proof, right? I've given a reason and a conclusion. Unfortunately, the reason does not result in the conclusion, right? And this is a fallacy. It's the structure of a colloquial proof, but is not actually using correct systems. Then there's hand-waving proofs, also a form of colloquial proof. Here's an example from Wikipedia. The period P of any non-trivial cycle of the Collatz function is of the form P equals that thing, where B is greater than or equal to 1 and AC equals 0. This result is based on the continuing fraction expansion of log 3 over log 2. Surprise! Right? Now, the idea here is to say enough that you believe somebody has proven it. You have some idea where to start if you're proving it yourself, but not actually do the proof. Right? So it says, this is based on something, right? We give you a few of the key components of the proof, but we don't actually give you the whole thing. Hand-waving proofs appear fairly often in conversation between practitioners of a field. So it's not uncommon, as I am talking with other computing professionals, to have them discuss some algorithm will be efficient or inefficient, and they will give some sort of hand-wavy proof like this. Like, oh, well, that will be slower than this other thing because of the logarithmic expansion of binary trees. And you're like, if you understand what they're saying, you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And if you don't understand what they're saying, you can say, wait, what? And then they can give you a deeper sense of a proof. We also have proof outlines. The goal of a proof outline is sort of give you enough waypoints in the construction of a proof that you could finish the construction yourself. So a hand-waving proof just sort of points at a handful of the ideas. The goal of a proof outline is give you all of the steps you would need, but not necessarily all of the easy steps in between. So here's a proof outline of the theorem that all primes greater than 3 are exactly one away from a multiple of 6. That's the thing I'm trying to prove, and I say this is because any number 6n plus I, where I is one of 0, 2, 3, or 4, has either 2 or 3 as a factor. Okay? Now this is not a full proof. You need to do some more work to get the full proof. But the goal is that all of the pieces you need to get there are present, and you just need to fill in how they're connected. Why does one thing follow from the other, and so on. All three of these kinds of proofs are fairly common. They aren't formal proofs, they are prose proofs, as we'll talk about later, but they're easy ways of communicating that I believe something and you should believe me that I know why. Okay? At different levels of detail. So often when you'll hear people say something is proven, this is what they'll provide. For example, the news. If the news refers to a new thing being proofed, you'll be lucky to get more than a hand-wavy proof. You'll actually be lucky to get a hand-wavy proof. Often they'll just assert that somebody has proven something and then mention what school they work at as sufficient evidence that they knew what they were saying. Much more like my first fallacy, right? And different sources will give you different levels of detail as you're going along. So, colloquial proofs. The next one we're going to talk about is a whiteboard proof. There's other things we could call this, sometimes it's called scratch work and so on. A core concept to understand about proofs is that they're bigger than you can fit in your head. It is unusual to have a proof that is small enough that you have the cognitive load sufficient to hold the whole proof in your head at once. And the idea of a whiteboard proof or a scratch paper proof or however you want to think about this is that I am putting down enough of the ideas in something I can look at that I don't have to hold them all in my head at once. I'm not tying them together in formal proof language. I'm trying to put all of the pieces there, though, unlike a hand-wavy proof, so that I have all of the bits and pieces, all of the steps to get from my theorem to truth, and I can understand them all by sort of thinking about one of them at a time and making sure they all connect. These are used both in creating proofs, almost all proofs. I would argue actually probably all proofs the first time, and almost all proofs in reality, are created with something like this first. You start by sketching out the ideas. And then once you have all the ideas sketched out, you then almost always condense it into something more appropriate for sharing. Because often you don't write down how everything's connected. And it may just look like a random series of numbers and symbols that don't have obvious relations, but because you wrote them, you know where it's all wrong, and you can then turn that into something clean. So you start writing proofs are also used for understanding proofs. When I am faced with a new proof I haven't seen before, I will typically decompose it into a whiteboard proof. Because the written form of proofs will generally sort of skip a lot of details. And so used in both directions of creating and reading proofs. And so this is something that we will use a fair amount in class as we try to explain various proofs. Often when people talk about proofs, they mean a prose proof. This is a form of language art. It is a writing art form. A writing art form whose goal is to convince you that math proves something. Okay? And as a language art form, it has a lot of nuances and special forms of expression and so on. Some of the weirdness about prose proofs is that the typeface, the shape of the letters you use, actually carries meaning. I have almost never seen a prose proof written in a sans serif font, which is just like, huh? But again, this is an art form. The goal is to communicate. The goal is to communicate an emotion, a sense of formality and impassion, as well as the actual material itself. And we are not going to spend enough time in this class or probably during your entire undergraduate experience to become an expert at this art form. We're going to try to at least get you some of the basic ideas so that you can be a competent amateur at writing this art form and at reading as an interest. So I have here an example of how this would work. Right? I have this theorem, there are infinitely many primes, and here I have an outline of a proof. And it uses specific techniques that we'll deal with as we go along, but I'll just start by pointing out one. I have proof period in italics, and I end it with a little rectangle. And these are just things we usually do in proofs. And actually, There are stylistic arguments about the rectangle. Should it be filled? Should it be hollow? Should it be written out as a QED or three little circles instead? Oh, right. Anyway, because it's an art form, you can have stylistic impressions. And we will try to explain some of those as we go along. But this is a big part of what we're going to try to help teach you to write and read, at least at a basic level in this class. Prose proofs. Then there are machine checkable proofs. We won't spend very much time on this. I had thought I would at one point, but I probably won't. Anyway, it turns out that certain classes of proofs you can write in tiny, tiny, tiny little steps, where every step is one of a small set of known okay steps. There will often be millions of them. And then you can have a small little program that will just check that every step follows one before, and if it ends with the theorem, huzzah, it is proven. And these are weird looking. Usually they don't look at all. This is as pretty a version of a machine checkable proof as I know of. This is a format called true functional logic, a slight variant of it to make it machine checkable. And as you might expect for something designed primarily for humans to read, not for humans to read, for machines to read, it has weird format. It is likely that you can look at this and not even know what it is trying to say, let alone if it said it correctly. But you could write a program of maybe 100 lines of code that could prove to verify this proof is correct or that it wasn't with sufficient energy. I had at one point actually planned on having you write such a thing in this class, but they all versions I know of that are reasonable to write require a fair amount of recursion, and recursion is technically not a prerequisite for this course. So we won't. I may, if I get my act together, decide to write up as an optional enrichment activity you can do on your own how to write such a proof checker, in case you're curious, but I'm not promising to do that. There are other versions of machine checkable proofs, and this is really a tiny one. They really truly are often millions of lines long, because they try to decompose everything into tiny little steps. And there's even a special version of something called proof carrying code, where you encode in specially formatted comments in your code the machine checkable proof that your code is correct. And this may or may not eventually become common enough we'll have to teach it, but right now it's mostly a curiosity. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we move forward. So all four of these things are thought of as proofs. The word proof is used for colloquial proofs, for whiteboard proofs, for prose proofs, for machine checkable proofs. And these can be written by humans or by computer or a mix of the two, usually a mix of the two. Turns out proving arbitrary theorems is impossible, and we can prove that, and you'll get to when you take CS3102 computational theory. But you can have these tools, like the tool Lean that is used in the other class, that will assist you in writing the proof. They'll do as much as they can and then wait for you to do the next thing. Because they can't do all of it, but they can take care of some of the details. And that's the easiest way to generate machine-checkable proofs. So there are famous theorems that are only known to be provable using a proof assistant because they have 600 cases, each of 1,000 steps, and humans just don't have that kind of patience. But these things exist, and we basically won't say anything more about them than what I'm saying right now in this version of this course. And that is the kinds of proofs. Questions about any of these kinds of proofs before I talk about why we're doing this? Okay, let me tell you the main thing I want you to remember from all of this. We'll get back to this later. The most important takeaway, a proof is a form of persuasive writing. I think we sometimes think about proofs as being fact. And they just, that there is a version of proof that we could think of as being fact. But that's not the version we're usually interested in. We're not usually interested in machine checkable proofs. We're usually interested in prose proofs or colloquial proofs. We're usually interested in persuading somebody else to believe
that something is inescapably true. And a lot of what we're going to deal with in this class is arguably sort of getting between the mathematical fact and the expressive argument. And one of the things to understand about this is proofs do not create truth. Okay? Any given thing you could say in a formal mathematical sense is either true or isn't. Whether we have proved it or not does not change its proof. The purpose of proof is not to make things true. The purpose of a proof is to convince people that things are true. It is a persuasive, it is, and in that, we're going to spend a lot of time dealing with math, and I'm just going to tell you things are true. I'm going to use the proof fallacy of appeal to authority. Because I am standing in front of the class and somebody is paying me to do so, you are going to trust me when I say. And occasionally I will dive into a proof to formalize that. Okay? That works sort of in a classroom. It doesn't work so well when you don't have some sort of authority relationship. And so you're going to need to persuade people of things all of your professional life. You're going to persuade people that things are inescapably true. Sometimes you're going to do this, some of you will go into academia and you'll have to write full formal prose proofs. Most of you are most likely instead going to go to industry, and what you're going to have to do is persuade your boss that you know that a task is easy or hard or doable or needs more work. Okay? You're going to have to explain to them the things they're going to teach you in subsequent courses about analysis of algorithms and so on, assuming they don't know algorithms. And so the techniques of being persuasive, of showing them you know the pieces in between, is going to be a useful skill. The other thing you're going to have to do, almost certainly all of your life, is listen to other people's hand-wavy proofs and realize they are wrong. Okay? People get hand-wavy proofs wrong a lot. It is probably the common case in most circles. Okay? Somebody says, this must be true because. And you need to realize, wait a minute, the because doesn't tie together. You have to recognize their slips in logic. You're going to need to do that. I'm not going to teach you how. I can't really teach you how because we are going to have to spend our time teaching you the things you're going to look for being wrong. Okay? This is the first class in a lot of these things. You're going to have to get there a bit at a time. But I want you to be thinking about that as you're going along, and as this semester progresses, I would encourage you to think about other communications you have, even outside of computing, to see if you see fallacious argument forms. Thoughts, comments, questions about proofs? Okay, you have paid for 2 more minutes of my time, and I don't like that time to be wasted, so we're now going to dive ahead with what's coming up a little bit. Because, you know, why would you pay me to be here and then not consume that? Of course, lecture's optional, so if you leave, just do so quietly. For class on Wednesday, we're going to talk about this particular article, The 6 Habits of Highly Mathematical People. Okay? This article... go away. All right. This article is written by a particular individual, just put it on his blog, huzzah. But I think it's a very nice summary of some things you're going to have to think about when you're being mathematicians that you don't have to think about as a math student. And part of this class is going to try to bring you from math student to mathematician. And so it's going to talk about these 6 ideas, discussing definitions, coming up with counterexamples, being wrong often and admitting it, evaluating many possible consequences of a claim, teasing apart assumptions of an underlying argument, and scaling the ladder of abstraction. We will spend class time on Wednesday talking about this, but I want to talk about just one of them right now in our remaining minute. Being wrong often and admitting it. A core concept of all kinds of formal and mathematical reasoning is you want to explore true and false statements, you can find the boundary between them. If all you ever say are true things, you're probably being way too overly cautious. Okay? So we want you to be right, and we want you to be wrong. And we want you to be comfortable being wrong. A lot of designing proofs is you guess what the proof will look like, and then see that you were wrong.
And in the process of seeing that you're wrong, you learn why you were wrong and then make a better guess next time. Being wrong often is a key part of this class. It's a key part of all kinds of mathematical thinking. And so I'd encourage you to think about this, about how you can be more comfortable with wrong, and read the rest of the article, which we will talk about when I see you on Wednesday.